Quiet and composed, contemplative almost, Rue sat at the Texas Hold'em table in one of the casino's private rooms. He smoked a big cigar and watched the other players. Six men and one woman still remained at the table. Only three of them, including Rue, were still in the hand currently being played out. The other four had thrown their hands onto the felt tabletop in disgust and studied their dwindling pile of chips. The game was all about skill and luck and husbanding the resources on the table. Rue studied his own stacks of chips. They looked positively anemic. The dealer looked at him.
In or out, Monsieur Lacroix?
Rue didn't really like that name, but he had to use it. The identity was a conceit that could conceivably backfire on him. He tried his best to live in the world without a paper trail. However, in order to qualify for the Texas Hold'em tournaments and other games he liked to play, he had to provide an identity that had some depth and texture. That was inherently dangerous.
In or out, monsieur?
Rue seethed inside. The cards had been so good to him at first, and now they ran cold. He kept his frustrations locked in, though. Even so much as a deep breath could have given away crucial knowledge about him to the other players. Declan Connolly was an Irish launderer worth millions. He sat solid and imposing on the other side of the table. As if he didn't have a care in the world, he sipped his whiskey straight up. He could drink for hours, and had been, and still play as though he were stone-cold sober. He'd also apparently brought the luck of the Irish with him. He'd hit on combinations during the night that had at first appeared all but impossible.
Come on, old man. You're squeezing onto them chips like they're the last ones you're likely to see in your lifetime. Of course, as old as you are. I guess maybe that could be the case.
Rue ignored the insult and concentrated on his cards. He wasn't going to let himself be baited. Two queens, hearts and diamonds, had shown up in the flop, the spill of the initial three community cards across the felt. Rue felt certain Connolly was holding another queen in his two down cards because the river was widely split unless someone was holding a queen. There was nothing really to build on in the river, and more than likely winning the hand would depend on pairing up cards. The third card was the Jack of Spades.
We really need to get on with this. I'd like to get in another hand before I go for the massage I've scheduled.
Rue eyed Beverly. She was a young woman from old money. He thought she might barely be in her 20s, but she was a beautiful English rose. He held the 10 and the King of Spades as his hole cards. Together with the Jack of Spades showing, he had a chance at a royal flush, provided that the next two cards dealt were the right ones. Rue knew that his luck hadn't been running like that. It was just that he couldn't let go of Connolly's constant heckling. The Irishman bared his teeth in a feral grin.
It takes nerve to play this game, Boyle. Maybe you already spent yours, huh?
I call.
The dealer turned a card and slid the turned card onto the felt. The Ace of Spades stood neatly beside the two queens and the jack. Now a potential straight lay in waiting. Some of the betting picked up pace. Rue reluctantly parted with his chips. One card in his favor didn't mean much, and he hated bidding on luck, but he couldn't walk away from the table.
Oh, growing a spine, old man.
Rue ignored Connolly. The dealer dealt the river, the final community card that finished the seven cards the players had to make a hand from. It was the Queen of Spades. Rue couldn't believe his luck. He kept his face neutral and didn't move. Connolly's left nostril twitched. It was a tell Rue had spotted hours ago. The man definitely had a queen among his hold cards. He now had four of a kind. The bet went to Beverly. She raised the stakes a little. Rue pushed the rest of his chips into the pot.
I'm all in.
Beverly tossed her cards onto the table. Connolly stared at Rue from across the table.
So, now it's just you and me, old man. You're so desperate you're trying to buy this pot, aren't you, huh? Well, that's what this is all about, isn't it? A big bluff at the end to show everybody you're not afraid to lose your money.
Rue returned the man's gaze without a blink.
Bit of theatrical nonsense is what it is. For you to beat me, you'd have to have the 10 and King of Spades. But you don't have them, do you?
The bet is to you, Monsieur Connolly.
Connolly waved impatiently at the dealer.
You're just smoke and mirrors, old man. I still remember that bluff you tried to run when we opened this game.
Rue had done that purposefully because the pot had been small enough that getting busted running a bluff wouldn't cost much. And he'd gotten caught doing it, as he had intended.
I hate bluffers. Either you have the cards you need to win or you need to go home. This game's about luck and skill, not about drama.
Actually, I prefer a man who knows how to make a production of things. Otherwise, this game becomes tedious. Except for the winning and losing, of course. I mean, that's why we're all here, right, Paddy? The winning and losing? So, are you going to talk and try to figure out if your friend is bluffing? Or are you going to play cards?
Connolly's face flushed a fairly hideous shade of red. Rue knew the woman's words had seared Connolly, sealing the deal. Although Rue had fewer chips, by going all in, he'd shoved enough into the pot that losing a matching amount would seriously impact Connolly's game. Rue was counting on the hand playing out and doing that very thing.
You don't have it,
Monsieur Connolly.
You don't have it!
Connolly shoved in stacks of chips to match Rue's wager. As if delivering the death stroke, the Irishman flipped over his hole cards and exposed the Queen of Clubs.
I've got four ladies, boyo. Unless you can come up with three kings or three aces in those two hole cards, you're beaten.
I can't do that, I'm afraid.
Without fanfare, Rue flipped his cards over to reveal his royal flush.
Ah, fucking hell!
Connolly violently pushed back from the table and stalked out of the room.
We have a scheduled break at this point.
Rue got up from the table and strolled out into the main casino. Standing on the second floor landing overlooking the main pit, Rue stretched slowly. There wasn't anything that felt as good as victory. If he ever lost that feeling, if he ever grew jaded with it, he honestly didn't know what he would do with himself. Living a long life could be incredibly boring and repetitious, especially in modern times. In the past, when the world had been wide open and a man had been free to fight wars and love women indiscriminately, when there had been so many things to discover, Rue had felt better about his long years. He had dined with kings, helped them slay their enemies, and aided them in seizing their crowns. He'd raised armies and fought tremendous battles. Every day, those stakes had been for his life or the lives of those around him. Now, though, he couldn't do those things. Warmongers tended to draw too much attention and the enmity of the world. World conquerors, he feared, were a thing of the past, when all it took was one man with a satellite and a long-range missile to put that would-be world conqueror in the grave. Thankfully, he had gambling, though the money was never an issue. He had more than he could ever spend in his long life, and there was more to be had if he needed it. One of the reasons he loved Anya Creed as he did was that she had that fire in her that he could barely remember. Still, she had Joan's sword, and that thing had never proved helpful in living a long life. He took out a hand-rolled cigar. It was a blend that he specially ordered. Cigars were one thing he'd never grown bored with. Despite the movement going on around him and the steady current of conversations, Rue sensed the movement behind him. He took another puff of the cigar and didn't react.
They're happy.
Yes, they are.
Beverly stepped to his side and joined him at the railing above the pit.
You knew I was there.
Yes.
Yet you ignored me.
Oh, trust me, dear girl. You're not easy to ignore.
Well, then why don't you pay more attention to me?
Rue took in Beverly's slender figure. The black pants, black jacket, and white blouse almost looked like a business suit. But the tailor had made certain the material didn't hide the curves beneath. There was a generous expanse of cleavage.
How did you know I was there?
ESP?
No, I don't think so. Oh, you are a very interesting man.
Oh, I am.
And you certainly don't lack for confidence.
I find myself emboldened by your beauty. I find my spirit made larger for being in your presence. You'll have to forgive me.
Beverly's cheeks turned slightly pink. That had been unexpected. With all of her wealth, Rue would have expected her to be hardened to any form of flattery.
You talk a lot of nonsense.
Do you think so? I thought it sounded much better than telling you you had a great set of hooters.
You know, I could think you're hitting on me.
I'd be devastated to know that you approached me with anything less in mind.
You're entirely too confident.
You came over to meet me, didn't you?
Not because of any sexual allure.
Are you certain?
You're old enough to be my grandfather.
And that makes it even more intriguing, doesn't it?
Beverly smiled, but didn't deny it.
I like the way you handled Connolly.
The man was positively begging for a comeuppance of the rudest sort. Although, if the cards hadn't favored me, it could have been embarrassing.
He didn't know that you allowed yourself to be caught bluffing earlier.
Did I do that?
Yes. It was very carefully done, by the way.
Thank you.
I don't think anyone else caught on.
Yet you did.
Mm-hmm. Truthfully, I think I'm better than anyone else in that room.
Ah, I see.
I don't mean to take anything away from you. You're a very good card player.
Again, you're too kind.
No, I've seen some of the best. That's why I'm surprised I've not crossed paths with you before.
I play a small game.
By choice. You could be playing in one of those television tournaments.
Rue waved that away and took another puff off his cigar. He rounded his ash into a nearby ashtray.
I've no interest in that. Entirely too much attention.
I can't believe you'd be shy.
Perhaps I just prefer a gentleman's game among friends.
The way you ambushed and baited Connolly wasn't very gentlemanly.
Well, he isn't by any stretch of a generous imagination anywhere close to being a gentleman.
No, but I have to wonder what you're all about.
Then I'll just say that I like being mysterious. I found that women think it's attractive.
It is.
Rue turned to face the young woman, giving her an appraising look.
So is your intent in meeting me merely to get a better sense of my game? Or do you have something else in mind?
Beverly's stare returned his challenge full measure.
You honestly don't care if I take you up on that or not, do you?
I do, but if you feel disinclined, I won't be devastated.
That was true, but he seriously doubted she was going to walk away. She was much too competitive. Beverly traced the back of Rue's hand with her forefinger.
We do have time for dinner before the game resumes.
We do.
I've got a big room. We could order in.
That sounds absolutely delightful.
Still robbing the cradle, I see.
Jolted by memories of the past, Rue turned to face the woman leaning against the rail only a few feet away. Dread, anticipation, and wariness spun inside him.
Jennifer.
Jennifer Bailey was a goddess of the night. When Rue first met her, that thought had leapt into his head and never left. Her skin was flawless, warm toffee, and her eyes were a brown that seemed to glow with an inner fire. 5'8" tall with generous curves, she turned heads and silenced conversations every time she entered a room. Her hair was cut short and framed her beautiful face. She wore a scarlet dress that dipped low and was cut high, stopping just short of being tacky. As he gazed at her, Rue tried to remember how long it had been since he'd last seen her. At least 10 years had passed. That meant she had to be in her early 40s, but she did not look her age. Beverly bridled at once, obviously irritated that their conversation had been interrupted. Rue smiled at that, but when it came to class, Jennifer Bailey beat the younger woman hands down.
It's good to see you again.
Is it? The last word I received from you was a note on a pillow telling me you had things to do. That was 13 years ago.
13? Really? A wretched number, filled with ill-fated consequences.
It's been a long time.
Jennifer gazed at the young woman at Rue's side, giving her an appraising once over.
I can see you haven't changed a bit.
My predilections remain as constant as a North Star.
And remain as predictable. That's how I found you.
It took a long time.
Jennifer shrugged, an elegant shift of her shoulders.
I've thought of you often.
And I've often thought of kicking your skinny ass for leaving without a proper goodbye.
Jennifer put her hand on her hip and stared at Beverly.
I'd also dare say you haven't thought of me for at least 10 or 15 minutes.
Do you know this woman?
Beverly stepped close enough to Rue to partially claim him as her territory.
I do. Beverly, I'd like you to meet Jennifer Bailey. She's an artist. Maybe you've seen some of her work?
I'm not much into greeting cards, I'm afraid.
Actually, Jennifer's work has hung in some of the finest European and African galleries. Jennifer, this is Beverly. Her family owns the Topaz Hotel in London, among others.
Perhaps you didn't notice, but we were engaged in a private conversation.
That's all right. We're old friends. Evidently, you're going to be another new friend. He doesn't make many friends who turn into old friends.
Well, you've certainly got the old part covered. After 13 years and a note on a pillow, I'm surprised you'd consider yourself a friend.
Youth can be diverting, but it's also flighty and annoying, especially on a self-indulgent, high-maintenance narcissist.
A man prefers new challenges to old conquests.
Maybe we should let him be the judge of that.
Rue, a master strategist on the battlefield and a leader of warriors, suddenly found himself in the worst possible position any man could face. Both women looked at him expectantly. Rue decided to double down on the risk. He'd gone in search of neither of the women. He could just as easily dine alone. And the night was still young. There would be other opportunities.
Perhaps we could have dinner and reach some kind of accord that would be less adversarial, though not without mutual reward and benefit.
Really?
You really haven't changed, have you?
There was a time when you weren't so quick to turn down new experiences. I seem to recall you introducing me to one of your girlfriends shortly after we met.
Enough of this nonsense. I have a lead on the Nephilim.
Excitement filled every molecule of Rue's body. Jennifer was one of the few people he'd told about the Nephilim painting.
Do you know where it is?
I found someone who might know.
Where is he?
She. And I'm not going to tell you. I'm going to take you there.
You know how dangerous that is. You've seen how Salome can be.
I still wear the scars.
You're lucky to be alive. Tell me.
No. I've worked on this since you've been gone. I'm not just going to hand it over to you and watch you walk away.
It would be better if you did.
We're not going to live forever. Isn't that what you used to say? But look at you. You haven't aged a day.
Jennifer.
No. I'm in or I'm gone. That's the deal.
All right.
What? You're just going to leave with this woman?
As gallantly as he could, Rue took Beverly's hand in his. He kissed the back of her hand gently.
Until we meet again, dear girl. Beat Connolly for me. I'll see you when I can.
Rue turned and took Jennifer by the arm and headed down the sweeping staircase. His thoughts centered on the painting of the Nephilim and the secrets it hid. He knew he was the most excited he'd been since finding the final piece of Joan's sword and watching it mend itself in an eye blink in Anya's hand. But he was also afraid. Anya stared at the armed men on the other side of the limousine's tinted window. They threatened her with the handguns and machine pistols they held. At least three of the five wore green scimitar tattoos at their throats. If the others did, the shadows hid them.
Come out!
I suppose getting out of this while in the car is out of the question.
Yes.
We could stay in the car and call the police.
Until they decided to blow us up or drill holes in the car roof and flood the interior with gasoline.
Aren't you the pessimist?
No, it's what I would do under similar circumstances.
On the other hand, we might be able to stay in the car long enough for the police to arrive.
I'd rather keep the authorities out of my business.
One of the men slammed his clenched fist against the tinted window.
Get out of the car! Now!
It's a pity about the dress.
What?
Excuse me.
Garin gripped the hem of her dress and tore it up to her hip.
Hey!
The open-handed blow landed hard enough to split Garin's lower lip.
You couldn't move in that dress as it was. I was trying to help you.
Oh, you should have said something.
The man at the window used his gun butt to rap against the glass this time. Then he reversed it and shoved the barrel against the glass.
Is the glass bulletproof?
Against those weapons, it should be. Of course, that also means that I can't shoot back at them. By the way, would you like a pistol?
At Garin's touch, a section of the wall slid back to reveal a dozen handguns, two shotguns, three assault rifles, and two machine pistols. Oil gleamed on the metal.
You wouldn't have a rocket launcher in there, would you?
Garin pressed a recessed release button on the seat in front of them. The cushion flipped over to expose three rocket launcher tubes.
I keep it fully stocked. So, would you like a weapon?
Well,
it's us or them, and I'd much rather it be them.
Anya took two of the 9mm pistols.
Good.
Anya tucked one of the pistols between her knees and used the release button behind the trigger guard to drop the ammunition magazine. The bullets gleamed in the clip. The man at the window stepped back, gesturing at his companions. For a moment, they all fell back. Then another man came forward with a trenching tool and a can.
That would be the gasoline.
The man stepped up onto the limo's trunk.
We do have one thing in our favor.
I'd love to hear it.
At this point, I don't think they want to kill you. I think they want to use you as a bargaining chip against Rue.
Still, not getting that warm, fuzzy feeling.
The man outside hammered the trenching tool against the car's roof. A dent took shape at once. Anya knew the roof was reinforced when the tool didn't immediately rip through. Garin reached for a remote control in a pocket on his door.
I do have one surprise left. Be prepared to move.
I am.
We go straight into them and hope they hesitate without firing into the middle of each other.
Garin took a sawed-off pump-action shotgun.
Then we cross the street and try to take the high ground.
Okay.
Ready?
Anya kicked her shoes off and gripped the guns.
Ready.
Garin pressed a button on the remote. Immediately, the man on top of the limo started jerking and jumping. Then he fell from the car and lay prone on the ground. The trenching tool and the gas can landed beside him. Garin reached across Anya and opened the door.
Go!
Anya stepped out into the alley and swiveled past the open door. She started to slow, but Garin put a hand into her back and shoved her forward. Thrown off stride, she stumbled, but quickly recovered. The men faced her, but their attention was still partially on the quivering man on the ground. Anya ran toward them and hoped that Garin was right about them wanting her alive. They brought their weapons up, then hesitated as they realized their companions were in their line of fire. Instead, they transformed into a solid wall of flesh and blood to block her. Garin ran at Anya's heels. He scooped the can of gasoline and flung it at the men.
Drop!
As she spun and dropped into a crouch, Anya watched the gas can fly above the heads of the men. When the metal container reached chest level, Garin fired the shotgun. Instantly engulfed in flames, the line of men broke. Anya winced at the heat, but Garin shoved her into motion again.
Run!
Anya sprinted for the opening.
Someone cover!
A man clawed at her arm. She pointed one of her pistols in his direction. A fire-enshrouded man blocked her way and lunged at her out of mindless terror rather than by design. Garin's shotgun boomed again. The fiery man whirled like a top and fell away. Anya ran across the street. She glanced to her left and was almost blinded by the oncoming vehicle's lights. The car came straight at her. Unable to turn back, slow, or outrun the car, Anya did the only thing she could do. She leaped up and forward. The incredible speed she sometimes acquired during periods of increased adrenaline saved her. Her foot touched the car's hood and she leaped again, throwing herself forward. As she flipped, she brought both of her pistols to bear. Anya landed on her feet, arms thrown out for balance. Garin ran by and caught her by the arm. He yanked her into motion. Somehow, she managed to stay on her feet as she went from 0 to 60 in one of his strides. Bullets chopped into the street and the buildings as Anya and Garin fled toward the alley. People at an outdoor cafe a block away screamed and took cover. Anya felt the rough street surface tear at her bare feet. Cats scattered from the crooked line of garbage bins lining the walls. Anya started to glance back when Garin yanked her arm again.
Don't look!
Garin caught hold of a fire escape zigzagging up the side of the building. He rounded the corner and headed up. Bullets from their pursuers' weapons licked sparks from the iron structure. Anya paused at the bottom of the stairs and took aim. No one was out in the street except the men chasing them. Two of the men sprawled onto the street. Others broke ranks and dove for cover. A few stood their ground and fired assault rifles on full auto. In the next instant, the limousine blew up. A concussive wave rolled over the men and knocked them flat.
Hurry! Are you going to wait around for them to recover?
Anya grabbed the railing and started up. Garin waited for her at the top of the four-story building. Below in the street, the men had regrouped and charged for the fire escape.
Why did the car blow up?
Anya tried to ignore the pain in her bare feet from the rocks across the rooftop. Garin pulled a remote control from his pocket.
I blew it up. I don't like to leave incriminating evidence behind. The explosion should at least confuse the police and help build a case for deniability. There are some drawbacks to the modern technology.
We were riding around in a car filled with explosives?
No, there were just enough explosives in the car to dispose of it.
What about the driver?
He's long gone by now.
Garin gazed down at the street. As Anya watched, four sleek black cars screeched to a halt in the street. Men got out of the vehicles with grim efficiency and unlimbered weapons. For a moment, Anya thought that reinforcements had arrived. Then the men started firing on the would-be kidnappers.
Your security team.
A little late, but that was my fault. I had them securing the club I was going to take you to.
I hadn't agreed to go.
You would have.
Anya took partial cover behind a gargoyle at the corner of the rooftop and looked down. Methodically, the new arrivals killed the men left in the street. Only a few escaped. The security team checked the men on the ground and shot those still alive. Sickened, Anya turned back to Garin.
Call them off.
That isn't necessary.
I think it is. They tried to hurt you.
Well, that's my problem.
While you were in my care, that's intolerable. I didn't get to where I am by being weak or showing compassion to those who declared themselves my enemies. You know history. That's true of every ruler that claimed territory as his own.
Anya tried not to think about what was happening down there.
Let me get you somewhere safe. Staying to answer questions for the police isn't going to help you any.
Not knowing what else to do, not relishing the possibility of returning to the police station, Anya nodded.
Okay, I know where to go.
This isn't the safest place for you.
Anya met Garin's glower with one of her own.
I might point out that being with you didn't prove to be safe either.
She walked along the hallway to her hotel room in her bare feet. An older couple passing by stared at her and Garin in consternation. It didn't help that four of Garin's men in black suits followed them.
We were mugged.
The woman's eyes filled with sympathy, but neither she nor her husband stopped.
I was the one in danger. If I hadn't been with you, they would have tried to kill me.
So this is my fault?
It's hardly my fault.
Anya slid her hotel door card through the slot. The light turned green and the electronic lock disengaged. She stopped inside the door and blocked Garin's way. He stared at her.
Surely you're jesting.
Nope.
You're not going to let me in?
Not by the hair of my chinny chin chin.
That's stupid.
I don't think so.
Damn it, Anya.
Anya tried to close the door. Garin blocked her efforts with a hand.
Take your hand out of the door, unless you don't need those fingers anymore.
You need me.
Never.
We were having such a good time.
Anya pressed on the door. Garin wiggled his fingers.
Ow! You're hurting my hand!
Take it out!
I can't! You've got it trapped with the door.
Anya eased back on the door. When she did, Garin leaned into it and shoved it open.
No! Oh, get out!
Garin ignored her and went to the couch. The room was small, and he seemed to fill the space even while seated.
I'm not leaving until I know that you're safe.
You don't like me, remember? I'm the reason Joan's sword is whole again, the reason you might not live forever.
Don't tempt me. I'm feeling favorable toward you at the moment, but if I ever find one gray hair, that might change. And as difficult as you're being, that could happen tonight.
I could call hotel security.
You could, but they don't have enough people here to throw me out. They'll have to call the police. Then the police will have questions they want answered. They won't make me leave. They'll take both of us into custody.
I'm willing to go. Are you? Or are you afraid of being inconvenienced?
I have friends everywhere. The local police will hold me only as long as I allow them to. You, however, they would hold longer. If only to spite me, because they might think we're involved. And that might be quite amusing. And I have no reason not to believe you'd be safe with the police.
Let's do that, then. Make the call.
No.
Coward.
Bitch.
Sticks and stones.
Anya folded her arms and stared steadily at Garin.
Tell me about Saladin and the Nephilim again.
I've told you everything I know.
I don't believe you.
Of course you don't. Believing me would be entirely too easy.
Irritably, Garin took his phone from his pocket and glanced at the caller ID panel. Scowling, he pressed a button and held it to his ear.
What do you want, Rue?
Some of the anger and frustration Anya had been feeling drained away as she listened intently. But she couldn't hear Rue's side of the conversation.
I'm on my way. As soon as I make arrangements, I'll let you know when to expect me. Well, that certainly changes things.
What?
I've got to go.
Garin walked to the door and opened it, stepping into the hall. The four security men stood post in the hallway.
Where are you going?
Rue called.
I know that. The two of you hate each other.
Not always.
Anya knew that was true. At times, the two men seemed to care for each other deeply. Then they would try to kill one another. Keeping up with their relationship was confusing.
Now? Now you like each other?
We'll see how it works out.
This is about the Nephilim painting, isn't it?
So now you want to be my friend?
For the moment. I'm going with you.
Oh, no, you're not.
Without warning, Garin leaned forward and kissed Anya. As Anya felt Garin's lips pressing to hers, her synapses fired in warning and excitement. After a moment, she recovered enough to draw back to punch him. Instead, he pushed her back into her room, grinned, and closed the door. Anya blinked in astonishment at the closed door for a second.
Oh!
Anya opened the door and tried to step out, but she was instantly confronted by Garin's four security men. They didn't move out of her way, and Anya got the distinct impression that any physical effort she put forth would be countered. Garin was already at the elevator down the hall.
Take care, Anya.
Come back!
Thank you, but no. Tonight has been an exercise in frustration on any number of levels. And I don't know that Rue is going to offer anything better.
Where are you going?
If you're really interested, maybe I'll tell you someday. Over dinner. The next time, you can cook.
I wouldn't bet on it.
I like steak, potatoes, maybe a wedge of apple pie and ice cream. I'm really a simple man with simple tastes.
Garin stepped into the elevator, waved to her, and smiled. The elevator doors closed. Angrily, Anya drew back and slammed the door shut on the security men. Anya laid back, soaking in her bathtub, trying to push past the evening's frustration and answerless questions.
Oh, no. No, 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 no. Go away.
She wanted to ignore the knock. If it was Garin, she was certain he wouldn't tell her anything. If Saladin's men were knocking, and there was no reason they would, she told herself, she didn't want to be caught in the bathtub. Grudgingly, she climbed from the scented water and toweled off.
Coming.
Anya dressed quickly, pulling on her bra and panties, then covering that with jeans and a long-sleeved white shirt. She padded barefoot to the door.
Open up, Miss Creed. We know you're in there. This is the police.
Anxiety pulsed through Anya. She peered through the peephole. Two men stood in the hallway. One was Skromach, the police detective who'd investigated the bombing on the movie set. The other was younger and slimmer, but he looked as much like a cop as Skromach.
Miss Creed!
I didn't call for the police!
Anya felt like an idiot saying that, as if she were protesting a pizza delivery.
We need to speak with you, Miss Creed.
Desperation set in then. Anya retreated from the door and crossed to the bed where her backpack and boots were. After grabbing both, she headed for the balcony. She was only four floors up. The climb wouldn't kill her. The fall might, but the climb wouldn't. She slung her backpack over her shoulder and opened the balcony door. Three men, all of them dressed in tactical riot gear, stood on her balcony. They looked at her.
Perhaps it might be better if you went the other way and accompanied the detectives.
Sure. That would be just great.
By the time Anya turned around, the detectives had let themselves through the door with a hotel passkey.
Ah, Miss Creed. So we did catch you at the hotel.
Anya frowned, knowing the verb was an intentional choice.
We'd just like you to come with us down to the police station.
Why?
We have a few questions we'd like to ask you. About a dozen or so men that were killed earlier this evening.
Don't I get to call the United States Embassy?
Oh, perhaps. We're hoping that such a thing won't become necessary. We're certain that all of this is just a misunderstanding and can be cleared up in a short time. Please?
May I put my boots on first?
Of course.
Anya woke 14 hours later when the door to the interview room opened. She lifted her head from her forearms. Her vision was blurry at first, and a headache throbbed at her temples. Her return visit to the police station was less friendly than the first time. Earlier that day, yesterday, she reminded herself, she'd almost been a guest. A dark-complexioned man approached the table. He wore an expensive suit and looked elegant.
Good morning, Miss Creed.
You're not a cop.
May I sit?
I'm not here in the position of hostess.
The man grinned, then pulled out the unadorned straight-back chair on the other side of the conference table. Unlike Skromach and his companion, this man didn't carry a file folder with her name on it.
Thank you.
Who are you?
The man spread his hands in front of his face and smiled again.
I could be your friend.
Wariness filled Anya. She crossed her arms and studied the man. He was in his late 30s and physically fit. A thick shock of black hair and a small, neat goatee framed his lean, hard-planed face.
I've got enough friends.
I've found in my business that a person cannot have too many friends.
I don't usually meet my friends in police stations. I think I'll pass on the offer.
Well, judging from this rather bleak room, it seems to me you could at least use one more friend at the moment.
What would this friendship cost me?
I'm sure we could arrive at something.
No, thank you.
Something hardened in the man's dark eyes, and Anya felt the small hairs on the back of her neck rise.
Perhaps you shouldn't act so rashly.
Do you call yourself Saladin?
As a matter of fact, I do. My father named me that, as his father named him. That name has been handed down in my family for generations.
I suppose it saves on monogramming, but it must be confusing at family gatherings.
A trace of a scowl tightened Saladin's mouth.
Do you amuse yourself with your own wit, Miss Creed?
I do. But you're the one who chose to barge in and play. How'd you get past the police?
I'm not without resources. As I said, I could be a good friend to have.
Trust is a big issue with me.
Saladin favored her with a smile.
You can trust me.
You sent those men after me.
Saladin shrugged and grinned, a playful twinkle that Anya didn't like at all glinting in his eyes.
All work and no play tends to dull the minds of the men working for me. You're a cipher to me, Miss Creed. I don't like ciphers. How is it that you know both Rue and Garin Braden?
That's none of your business, but I will tell you this. The Nephilim painting you're after? I don't know anything about it.
Saladin studied her, and Anya noticed that one of his eyes was of a slightly different color than the other. The left one held a splash of green in the upper right quadrant.
Even if that were true, those two men value you.
Those two men left me to my own devices while knowing full well that you were hunting me. Does that sound like they value me?
I guess the only way to truly know that is at your funeral.
Saladin got up from the chair and left the room. Anya frowned as the door lock clicked back into place. Hours later, Anya didn't know how much time had passed because she didn't have access to her watch or any of her electronics. Another man entered the room. He looked around cautiously, almost a little fearfully.
Miss Creed?
He held his briefcase in front of him like a shield. He looked as if he was barely into his 20s. Youth left his face soft and round. Glasses gave him a vulnerable look. His hair was already getting thin on top.
Yes.
I'm Walter. Walter Gronlund. I'm with the State Department.
Don't tell me. The United States government wants to place me under arrest also.
Walter pushed his glasses up his nose with a forefinger.
Actually, no. I'm going to get you out of here.
Oh. I hope to God what you're saying is true. Forgive me, but do you happen to have any identification?
Of course.
Walter reached into his jacket and took out a leather identification case. The photo ID looked just like him and announced that he worked for the United States Embassy in the Czech Republic. Nervously, Walter settled his briefcase on the table.
I think they've got someone coming with your things from the hotel.
Why are they bringing my things from the hotel?
That way you don't have to stop on your way to the airport. We're getting a police escort to the airport, so getting there in time for the flight shouldn't be a problem.
What flight?
Your flight, Miss Creed. You have been asked to leave. Effective immediately.
I don't believe it. They're kicking me out of the country?
That's an awfully blunt way to look at it, Miss Creed.
Is there any other way to put it?
Actually, there is. They're rescinding your visa.
Stunned, Anya slumped back in her chair. Despite the impatience that screamed through her, Salome forced herself to sit quietly in the plush chair amid all the other potential buyers. She knew many of them. Over the years, they'd all crossed paths. Many of them watched her covertly and quickly glanced away when she looked in their direction. She took a certain amount of pride in her reputation. She'd worked hard over the years to attain it.
Our next item, ladies and gentlemen.
The auctioneer was a fastidious man in a good suit. Two young women, both dressed in low-cut gowns that threatened to expose them, presented an antique silver tea service. After they had the item properly positioned to show it off to its best advantage, the young women stepped aside. After referencing the 3x5 card that accompanied the piece, the auctioneer looked back over the expectant crowd.
This 6-piece tea service was once owned by President Andrew Jackson while he resided in the White House. The set has been authenticated as having been made by Jabez Gorham himself very early in his career.
Salome checked the details of the tea set in her catalog out of habit. The tea service was worth quite a bit. Salome quietly wondered how and where the auction house had gotten its hands on such a prize.
Shall we open at 3? Yes. 3,000 to you, sir. 3,100. 3,300. I'm bid 3,500 from the lady in the back. Any advance on... Yes, 4,000. I'm bid 4,000.
Bids were increased with the movement of a finger, the tap of an identifying number, or simply the wiggle of an eyebrow. Salome kept track of the bidding, not at all surprised at the brisk pace. Major buyers had known the service was going to be present. Auction houses in The Hague didn't often get such things. Salome immediately wondered if the tea service had been stolen at some point, or was even a very good replica. Either was possible. If a theft had occurred long enough ago, and if it had happened in another country, it was possible to get away with such a thing, especially if documentation was provided that checked out against art theft lists generated by Interpol and other international police agencies.
I bid 5,000. 6,000. Any advance on 6,000. Once. Twice. Sold for $6,000. Thank you, madam.
Salome judged that price to be at least 20% over fair market value. That told her whoever had purchased it had bought it out of love, not as an investment. She made a mental note of the transaction. Nothing she ever thought or observed or noticed was recorded anywhere. Her insight was much too valuable. Once the tea service was taken away, the two buxom beauties brought out the next piece. When Salome saw it, she stopped breathing for just a moment. She trusted that she gave no outward sign. To the room, she was prim and proper. The elegant Versace business suit, with pants, not a skirt, was the foundation of her professional image. Her brunette hair, parted on the left, hung to her shoulders and stayed carefully in place.
The next item up for bid is a painting by a little-known Venetian artist, Virgil Caralini.
Salome knew that was not true. Virgil Caralini's brush had never touched the canvas in the antique frame sitting at the front of the room.
Caralini's works are starting to find favor with collectors around the world. Some said he was a madman, that the visions he wrought so carefully on the canvas were merely fever dreams he trapped in paint.
A naked man lounged on a bearskin rug in front of a fire. He was beautiful. The fire warmed the man's dusky skin and backlit him so that the shadows gave him partial modesty. His black hair gleamed and framed his face in ringlets. He was huge and proportioned evenly, godlike in every way.
Oh, my.
Salome clamped down hard on the desire to backhand the woman. During her 36 years, 29 of them spent chasing objet d'art, beginning with her father when she was very young, she'd only felt this near loss of control a handful of times. She took a slow breath and let it out.
Who was the model?
It doesn't matter. Whoever he was, he's long dead. And the artist probably embellished that anyway.
The auctioneer smiled a little, and it was the first emotion Salome had seen out of the man the whole long morning.
Actually, if the rumors about this piece are true, the model could still be alive.
Salome's pulse quickened. She hadn't expected the auction house to have any of the real history of the painting. The secret was about to be exposed, and she wondered who was responsible. She knew that Rue would never have told anyone. In fact, 9 years ago, when she'd let him know how much she knew, he'd nearly killed her. She looked around again. There was no sign of the old man, or of Saladin. She would be doubly blessed. She wondered how she could have found the prize before Rue, but then fought the feelings of good fortune. She hadn't gotten the painting yet.
According to the legend surrounding this piece, the figure in the painting is a fallen angel.
He used a laser pointing device to indicate the fireplace.
If you gaze into the fire, you can see tormented souls twisting in hell.
At her distance, Salome couldn't see the figures, but she knew they would be there. The notebooks she'd studied, the ones found in Cosimo de' Medici's private collections, had shown sketches of the Nephilim.
And the shadow?
The auctioneer traced the curved shadow, barely visible on the right side of the painting.
This is supposed to belong to the artist who painted this piece.
Unless I'm mistaken, that shadow belongs to a woman.
You're not mistaken. Virgil Caralini was actually the pseudonym of a woman painter.
Oh, there weren't many of those in the 17th century.
Salome was relieved to realize they didn't know the painting was actually painted earlier than that. No one, except perhaps for Rue, knew the painting's true origins. And the old man wasn't telling.
No, there weren't many female painters for a long time.
The auctioneer let that sink in. Salome knew he'd expertly moved the piece from art to a definite acquisition for possible investment. Collectors and investors alike treasured the unique in that regard. The auctioneer moved the laser pointer again.
If you look into the shadows here, you can see what appears to be wings folded beneath the man.
I see them.
Salome did as well. She slipped her iPhone from her purse and typed quickly two words, "It's here." She glanced down fractionally to see the reply, "It won't escape us." She tapped in a reply, "Make certain it doesn't," and put the phone away.
May I start the bidding at 10,000? Any at 10? 8? 8,000 I bid. 8 and 5, 9. 9 and 5, 10. 11,000. 13,000. 15? Any advance on 15? Once, twice. Sold for $15,000? Thank you, madam.
Salome sat through 8 more items. She bid on a few, always stopping short of where she knew the final price would hit. Then the woman who had bought the painting got up to make arrangements for the acquisition. Salome did the same. While she was in line, she also rifled the woman's purse and found her identification without getting caught. As Salome left the auction house, she was met at the curb by a car. The man in the back seat got out and helped her inside. Riley Drake was a big man. He headed his own private security company and rented his shock troops out to countries around the globe. He'd grown up in England, but he'd learned his trade in the killing fields in Africa. He kept his head shaved and looked deadly earnest at all times. It was a quality that influenced CEOs and heads of state to do business with him.
Her name is Ilse Danziger. I got her address.
Drake nodded. He was also not much of a talker, which many of his employers appreciated. He only spoke when he had something to say.
She's having the painting transported to her house, but I don't know when.
We could take it during transport.
No. Then it looks like we're targeting the painting. No, this will play better if it looks like a home invasion.
You're afraid of that old man you told me about, aren't you?
I'm not afraid. I'm just knowledgeable enough to be wary.
Reaching over, Drake took her hand. His felt warm, confident, and strong.
I could have him removed.
Salome touched his face and smiled gently.
I would rather that be a course of action we have to follow rather than one we choose. For all I know, Rue doesn't even know the painting has surfaced.
You're sure this is the one?
The painting is right. I haven't seen it up close yet, but it matches the sketches in Cosimo de' Medici's journals.
And this thing is going to give you enough power to do anything you want.
With what this painting hides, a person will have the power to remake the world.
Salome willed him to believe her, even though he seldom believed in anything that he couldn't see with his own two eyes.
And if it's just a story?
I refuse to believe that. It's not just a story. Too many people are chasing after it.
You mean the old man?
More than just the old man.
I thought you said not many people knew about this.
They don't.
Salome knew that Drake was upset because she hadn't trusted him with everything she knew. Men were like that. They got their egos bruised easily. Even big men.
It's just that these things can be difficult to control, love.
Drake took her hand to his mouth and kissed her palm. The kiss sent tingles through Salome.
There's only one other. His name is Saladin. He's a very dangerous man.
Drake regarded her with his pale blue eyes.
I'm more dangerous, love.
Salome silently hoped so, but it wouldn't matter after they had the painting. Fall chill had settled into New York by the time Anya returned. As the jet came down, she glanced at the cold slate-gray ribbon that was the East River and tried to convince herself it was good to be home. She didn't buy it. She didn't get to stay and work on the movie. Hadn't been able to follow up on the King Wenceslas piece she'd planned for Chasing History's Monsters. Hadn't explored more of Prague's old town and didn't find out anything about what Garin and Rue were doing, or even if they were still alive. Saladin hadn't struck her as someone who would be easy to deal with. Probably none of the Saladins had been. Anya felt incredibly grumpy. She reached into her pocket, took out her phone, and turned it back on. Her menu showed 6 missed calls. 4 of them were from Doug Morrell, and she didn't want to talk to him at the moment. 2 others had come from Bart McGillie's cell phone and were only minutes old. Knowing that Bart had called lifted her spirits somewhat. Detective Bart McGillie of the New York Police Department had been Anya's friend almost from the time she moved to Brooklyn. One of Bart's superiors had seen Anya on Letterman and decided to call her in to consult on a case involving artifacts stolen from one of the smaller private museums in the city. Bart and Anya had hit it off from the beginning. Both of them had been working to get their careers started, and the case had ultimately helped them do that in their respective fields. Despite the fact that Anya's relationship with Rue and Garin sometimes caused problems because she couldn't tell Bart everything that was going on, they'd remained friends. She punched his number in.
Hey, it's you.
It is me. As it happens...
You're back in NYC, I know.
How did you know that?
Well, you get kicked out of a country, that country kind of lets your home country know about it, so they can check and make sure you make it home. A guy from the State Department called and wanted a background run on you, locally. I guess the feds have got a whole other book on what you've been doing elsewhere.
Terrific.
Anya suddenly felt worse, despite Bart's warm, friendly voice. She stood, retrieved her backpack from overhead storage, and shrugged into it.
Naturally, the captain sees your name, he calls me. I think he figures I'm the Anya Creed specialist.
You're stuck babysitting me.
Nope, not even. I got to fill out the background check for the State Department guy. Talked to him over the phone. He explained about the dead guys in Prague. I thought about telling him about the dead guys you sometimes left over here.
Thanks. Heaps.
I said I thought about telling him. I didn't actually do that. Figured it would have complicated things for you.
Anya fell into line and followed the passengers out. She even managed a smile for the flight attendants.
I called to let you know you're in luck.
How's that?
I'm here, waiting on you. You've got me to tote and carry the baggage, give you a ride home, and I'm going to take you to dinner. Sort of a welcome home, glad to have you thing, instead of a sorry you got kicked out of a country thing.
Thanks, Bart.
In spite of the turn of events, Anya was actually smiling by the time she deplaned.
Hey, I see you.
At the end of the boarding tunnel, Bart stood outside the ropes. He was 6'2" tall and solidly built, not a guy to trifle with. His dark hair was razor cut, and a permanent 5 o'clock shadow tattooed his jaws and chin. He wore a lightweight dark gray trench coat. He waved in a good-natured way that didn't befit the preconceived notions of a homicide detective, and she couldn't help but grin like a loon. Suddenly, it did feel good to be home.
Hey, Bart.
Bart put his cell away and gave her a hug as she approached.
Hey, kiddo. Let's go get your bags.
Yeah, I want to go home. I'm pooped.
They turned and headed toward the baggage claim, making it to the correct carousel just as the alert lights started flashing and the conveyor belt chugged into motion.
So, what's it like?
What's what like?
Getting kicked out of a country. I mean, that's gotta suck.
I really missed that sympathetic shoulder you always offer.
At least they didn't throw you so far under the jail that they had to pipe in sunlight.
I didn't do anything wrong.
Anya leaned through the crowd to collect a bag. She placed it beside Bart.
Is this it?
No.
No?
Be brave.
Anyway, it looked like you did plenty wrong. There were 14 dead guys. Some of them were shot, but there were half a dozen killed when the car you were riding in blew up.
I didn't do that.
Didn't kill anybody?
Blow the car up.
Anya snared another bag.
Is this it?
No.
An unhappy look crossed Bart's face.
You volunteered. I was going to grab a cab.
I didn't know you were caravanning through Prague. When I saw it on the Travel Channel, it looked like a party spot.
Anya pulled another suitcase from the belt.
I wasn't caravanning. And I didn't get to party.
This much luggage, there should have been camels involved. You know, maybe I need to start looking for a camel.
You're a big boy. You can handle this. I got it to the airport.
All the time I've known you, I've never seen you pack this much stuff. What could you possibly have needed? Is there anything left at home?
I was working on a movie. Not exactly a regular gig for me. I didn't know what I needed. They make a lot of extras for the DVDs these days. I knew I was going to be in some of them. I wanted to make sure I was dressed right.
Were you in the movie?
A couple of times when they needed background people. But I worked on three of the features regarding the artifacts they're using in the movie, as well as the history of Prague.
Did you meet the main actor? What's his name?
I did. Terrific kisser, by the way.
You're making that up.
Yes.
Bart looked a little relieved about that. They were attracted to each other, even still. But Bart was the marrying kind, the kind who'd want to put down roots and raise a family. That meant his wife couldn't be out in the field digging through broken Mayan pottery and possibly getting sniped at by grave robbers. And there was no way he was going to understand the sword and the problems it seemed to bring. Bart had recently called off an engagement he'd had, or the woman had. Anya wasn't exactly sure how that had gone down because Bart was busy pretending it had never happened.
So back to this shootout in Prague.
They were trying to kill us.
Us? You mean you and this guy, Garen Braden?
No, me, the Earps, and Doc Holliday. Yes, I mean Garen Braden.
Anya hadn't known what name Garen was doing business under in Prague. Besides, if the Prague police could track him down and make his life miserable for a while, he deserved it for running out on her.
Well, nobody seems to know who that guy is. I looked him up and didn't find anyone by that name who fits the information you gave the Prague police.
Anya pulled her last bag from the carousel.
He's got a lot of names.
You know, you really ought to watch out who you hang out with. You might not get in so much trouble that way.
I'll try to do better.
Anya looked at the pile of luggage, then looked around the baggage area.
Did you spot a camel?
Ah, there you are. My movie star, come back from so far away.
Maria Ruiz, the owner of Tito's Cuban Restaurant, threw out her chubby arms and wrapped Anya in a bear hug. Thankfully, it was after 8 o'clock and most of the dinner crowd was gone. Anya hugged the big woman back. A feeling of seriously being home washed over her. She hadn't realized how much she'd been gone lately until that moment. Of course, maybe getting tossed out of a country made her a little more grateful for the old neighborhood.
I hope it's not too late to get something to eat.
Maria smiled. She was short and stout, a pleasant, hard-working woman who drove her son Tito crazy while she managed the restaurant and he ran the kitchen. Together, they'd created a restaurant clientele that kept them busy all day long.
Never too late for you. Come, I get the two of you a table, then I fix you something special. You need something to put the meat back on your bones. You're getting too skinny. It's not healthy.
Anya knew better than to protest. She followed Maria back to the rear of the restaurant. In the next moment, Anya and Bart were seated. Tortillas, chips, and an array of salsa and cheeses were placed before them.
So, you didn't blow up the car, but maybe shot a few guys.
I don't know. Probably. It all got pretty crazy.
Anya poured salsa onto a tortilla, added cheese, and started rolling. Bart looked at her for a moment, as if deciding whether to say what was on his mind.
You know, you've been involved in more gunfights than anyone I know.
That wasn't exactly my choice. I'm an archaeologist.
And television host, author, consultant to museums, private collectors, and the NYPD on more than one occasion, and gunfighter.
I suppose you had time to figure out all this comic dialogue after you heard I was coming back?
I may have fine-tuned it a bit.
My advice? Find an appreciative audience. I just got kicked out of a country, remember?
How much trouble are you in?
I don't know. I don't think it's going to follow me back here.
I hope not. Are you planning on returning to Prague?
Anya popped a cheese-covered chip into her mouth.
Not any time in the near future. How good's my credit in the favor department?
You'll never get out of debt.
Well, then it won't matter if I go in a little more debt.
It's that kind of cavalier attitude that really gets you into trouble.
I need to know about a guy.
You seem to know more about Garen Braden than the rest of the world.
Not him. Someone else.
Bart reached inside his jacket and took out a small notebook.
Is this going to be like the time you asked me to check out a set of fingerprints and they turned out to belong to a person of interest in a 1940s Hollywood murder?
That had been Rue. Anya still didn't know what to make of that.
I hope not.
Okay.
Bart waited, pencil poised.
He calls himself Saladin.
First name or last?
I don't know.
Helpful? Not?
He came to see me while the Prague police had me. Actually, he came to threaten me.
Saladin, eh?
That's what he said.
The Prague police should know who he is.
If they're willing to tell you. They let him in to see me, and I got the distinct impression they were willing to let him do whatever he wanted to do.
Anya started to take another sip of her drink, but she suddenly felt eyes on her. The sensation of being watched was uncomfortable but not frightening. She'd experienced such things before. Women generally did. Usually it was better to just ignore things like that, but Anya was aware that she no longer lived in a usually world. She glanced at the window overlooking the street. Night had settled in over the city, and darkness hugged the doorways and alcoves. A figure stood at the window, and he was staring at her. Gaunt and dressed in rags, the old man looked more like a scarecrow than a human being. A ragged beard clung to his pointed chin. His hat had flaps that covered his ears and gave his face a pinched look. His eyes were beady and sharp, mired in pits of wrinkles and prominent bone. He lifted a hand covered in a glove with the fingers cut off, his dirty forefinger pointed directly at Anya. And even from across the room, she read his lips as they formed the words, Anya Creed, the world is going to end. Soon, Anya Creed, soon. Anya frowned. How did that homeless guy know her name? His forefinger tapped against the glass.
What are you staring at, that homeless guy?
Without answering, Anya got up and walked toward the front door of the restaurant.
Where are you going?
He knows my name.
A lot of people know your name. You've been on television.
Still, Anya felt drawn to the man for reasons she couldn't explain. Bart was suddenly at her side.
Do you know this guy?
Anya saw Bart's reflection in the glass next to hers. Both of them overlaid the old man for a moment. Terror filled the old man's eyes, and he opened them wide. He placed both palms against the window and shook his head. Anya kept moving, and Bart matched her step for step. Maria hurried over as she wiped her hands on a bar towel.
What is the matter? You don't have to go, do you? Your food is not ready.
The old man turned and fled before Anya reached the restaurant door. By the time she was out on the street, he was gone. She jogged to the corner, but there was no sign of him. Bart surveyed the street up and down.
Do you know him?
No, but he knew me. He called me by name.
Television.
Does he look like the type to watch television on a regular basis?
He looks more like the type to have aluminum foil packed into his hat.
Anya turned back to Maria, who stood in the doorway and peered out.
Did you see that man?
I did.
Do you know him?
Not so much. I never seen him before, then poof, he is here. Like a wizard.
He's here?
Yes, the last 2 or 3 days maybe. Always looking in the windows.
Maybe he was just looking for a handout.
Come back inside. Your food will be up soon.
After dinner, Bart drove her to her loft. He parked in front of the building and placed his police identification sign on the dashboard as Anya got out. She checked the time and found it was a little after 9. Bart reached into the car's trunk and started removing suitcases. He put them on the sidewalk.
We'll just take out a few. No more than we can carry, and we'll leave the rest safe in the car.
Wait here. Wally has a cart we can use.
Inside the building, Anya knocked on Wally's first-floor apartment door. The building superintendent had one of the smaller units in the structure, but he kept it clean and neat. Wally took care of Anya's mail and her plants while she was gone. Wally answered the door himself, still clad in his work clothes.
Anya, it's good to have you back.
It's good to be back.
I figured you'd call first.
I would have. I apologize. I came back early.
Nothing to worry about. You need help with anything?
I'd like to borrow the cart, if I may.
Sure.
Wally stepped back into the apartment and returned with a small four-wheeled cart.
You're not going to try to carry that stuff in yourself, are you?
Bart's with me.
Oh, good. I like to watch a young man work.
Wally guided the cart through the door and walked out with Anya.